Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, ticketing, Sky, Prince. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
How are you?
Actually, I've been quite ill all week.
Well, no, sorry, that I made it sound like you had a long story, so let's move on.
But
how am I? Oh, I'm all right, a bit of a cold, but, you know, can't complain.
Bet my cold's worse podcast. Than your cold.
I don't know.
But mine was a Northern Irish cold, because I got my cold in Belfast.
What are you saying?
Well, Northern Irish colds are famously worse than Kent colds, and you had a Kent cold. So therefore, I beat you, I think, is the point of this conversation. Can I do a plug?
Well, you did a lot of plugs a few weeks ago.
I know, but a few weeks have passed since then.
We might still be a little bit over.
As you've noted, quite a few weeks have passed since then. So we announced last week details of the first ever Artist Entrepreneur Day that CMU DIY and the Featured Artist Coalition are presenting on the 1st of March in Cambridge as part of the City Roots Festival in Cambridge. So this...
Right. Yeah, if you're in Cambridge, it's going to be in Cambridge, isn't it?
It is, yes. Are you picking holes in the way I'm describing this?
Yes.
I don't know what I said in that sentence.
You said you were doing a thing in Cambridge that's in Cambridge.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. It's good to reaffirm it. Yeah. You know, you have to say things several times.
It's in Cambridge, by the way, this event.
For it to go in. So,
where is it?
It's in Cambridge.
Okay.
And CMU DIY and the Featured Artist Coalition, we piloted this event last year and it all went really well, but we have evolved it quite a bit since then. And so I'm very excited about it because it sort of means that it's kind of all new and it's going to be hosted by three artist entrepreneurs. So Roxanne, Sebastian, Shoudo and Echoes are basically hosting the day. And the way it's going to work is they are basically going to put their individual artist businesses, because you know how all artists are also a business.
Yes.
So if you're starting out as an artist, unfortunately, or fortunately...
Except the ones who don't sell anything.
Except the ones who don't sell anything.
I mean, you know, the ones who intentionally don't sell anything.
But
you might be an artist business and not sell anything.
As an artist today, as well as...
Not these ones, I should add.
Now I've lost my flag. As an artist today, as well as writing songs and recording and performing, you need to think about the business side of what you are doing. These are three artists who very much do that. And so they are basically going to be putting their artist businesses on show. I'm going to be presenting a few of our CMU DIY guides on things like music rights and gigging and direct-to-fan and business partners. And we'll have various other guests coming in from labels and publishers, etc., offering their advice and answering questions. But as we go through the day, our three hosts are then going to give practical examples of their business. So I'll explain a little bit about copyright, and then they will pick out a recording that they've released, a song they've written, and we'll dissect that, and they'll explain conversations they had with their collaborators and how they distributed it and how they've monetized it. And then we'll repeat the same for live and the same for merch. And they'll also talk about the business partners they work with and why they chose those people, etc. And I suppose the format of the day is the audience, I think, will be mainly made up of aspiring artists or people at the start of their artist careers. And it will enable them to take the sort of facts that I bring and our industry guests bring, but put them into much more practical scenarios. So I think it's going to be a really good day. So the very first Artist Entrepreneur Day is taking place on the 1st of March in Cambridge.
In Cambridge?
Did I mention that? It's happening in Cambridge. If you go to cmudiy.com, you'll see a big AE Artist Entrepreneur logo on the front page. Click on there. All the information are there. It's free, so you can book your tickets through the CMU DIY website. And we're going to do this in various places around the country over the next 12 months.
So you don't have to travel to Cambridge.
No, but if you're in or near Cambridge, then you should come. So it's going to be a good day. And that is happening on the 1st of March. That is this week's plug.
Good.
No more plugging, except that there is an industry takeover seminar happening on Tuesday night. But that only works if you listen to this podcast as it comes out. We like people who listen to the podcast the minute it goes online. They're our favourite listeners. Although, if you were very quick to the podcast last week, I kind of screwed it up.
You did.
In the edit. I did something at the last minute, which I thought was improving things.
It made it a lot worse.
Well, actually, what it was I said something that I realised was not quite right. And so I deleted it out of the final edit. But what I forgot was that, I only deleted the conversation bit of the podcast, not the jingles bit. So yeah, the jingles were slightly out of sync. I think for the first 60 people to download the podcast before we realised it, we realised it, didn't we? We both realised that there was the error.
Yeah.
And I fixed it. So we like you to be first listening to our podcast, but not super first.
Give us time to fix the error.
Because you might get an inferior. That's the first time that's ever happened in the 87 years we've been doing this. But listen on a Monday, and then things like me saying, tomorrow in London, it's the Entry Takeover Seminar, See Me DIY and Urban Development at Red Bull Studios. That makes sense, because it is tomorrow. So that's the message here. Hey, what are we talking about on this week's podcast?
Well, this week, we're going to be talking about your chance to own a bit of a Prince song, calls for sanctions against Spain's Performing Rights Collecting Society. But first, the UK government has laid out rules for secondary ticketing sites, clarifying what data they must display when reselling tickets. Most of those rules actually stem from the 2015 Consumer Rights Act, but there was some ambiguity in that legislation. So this all clears things up. And there's one brand new rule to, you know, make it seem like it's all new.
Now, if, like me, you read the statement that was put out by the Department of Business and whatever else is now under that particular government department.
Department of Stuff.
I think it has Industrial Strategy in its name. But if you'd read the statement they put out this morning as we record this podcast, and I did, you wouldn't necessarily be aware that most of what is in this document is a clarification of three-year-old legislation. They very much spun it as if this was new regulations. Most of it wasn't. So most of it does stem from the Consumer Rights Act. So that was passed back in 2015. It was a big piece of consumer rights legislation that covered all sorts of stuff. But there were two backbench MPs. So it wasn't the government who instigated this originally. So Sharon Hodgson on the Labour side, Mike Weverley on the Conservative side. And they used the fact that consumer rights were being reviewed in Parliament as an opportunity to try and sneak in some secondary ticketing regulation to basically limit and regulate and restrict the resale of tickets for profit through websites like Viagogo and StubHub, etc. Because the government had generally over the years been clear that there was no particular appetite for them to introduce specific legislation covering ticket touting. So yeah, Sharon Hodgson, Mike Weverley sneaked or snuck, one or the other.
Snuck.
You're going to have snuck. They snuck into the Consumer Rights Act. I mean, they had to get it passed in Parliament. I don't want you to think that they just waited until it being passed.
They just wrote it in biro at the bottom.
And nobody noticed and it became law. Well, it would be great if that was a way that you could make things law. So they managed to persuade the rest of Parliament to introduce these things. And so they became law in 2015. Although there were some ambiguities, as you say. And of course, there was always that issue of, is anyone paying attention to these new rules? Is anyone enforcing them?
Yeah, so one of the main ambiguities was that the new rules stated that there was bits of information that had to be provided when you were reselling tickets. But it wasn't clear if the onus was on the secondary ticketing website to provide that information or not. So I think the site took it to mean the sellers, actually the people who had the tickets, had to provide the information. And if they didn't, well, that's not the site's fault. We just won't display it.
Yeah, so when the people who are against ticket touting and want to see less ticket touting started complaining that there were still tickets going on sale on these sites without this information being provided, and they started shouting at StubHub and Viagogo and SeatWave, etc., they basically said, well, we've added the fields to the form. Yeah. Not our fault if people aren't filling them out. And so, yeah, there was the, okay, whose responsibility is it? Now, the other thing the Consumer Rights Act did, in addition to adding these few bits and pieces of regulation, it instigated the Waterson review of secondary ticketing, so the government review, one of several, of the secondary ticketing market. And actually, in many ways, his report that came on the back of that review settled that and cleared up that ambiguity. And he was pretty clear, no, there is an obligation on the sites to also ensure that this information is made available in addition to the sellers. Although I'm not sure that every single site has particularly gone above and beyond in ensuring that is happening.
No, and that, I mean, that information is things like, are there any restrictions in the terms and conditions of the ticket, such as, just off the top of my head, will it be cancelled if you resell it? You had to provide a seat number or general seating location, and you had to state the original face value of the ticket.
Yeah, and the ambiguity that the statement that came out from the government last week cleared up was when it said that restrictions on the ticket had to be declared on the site where you're selling the ticket, there was then some debate about, well, what restrictions does that mean? Now, given that these rules were specifically written to regulate secondary ticketing, in my mind, clearly, that means the restrictions you should be writing down are, this ticket clearly says it can't be resold and there is a risk that it might get cancelled. That would seem like that was one of the restrictions that it wanted you to share. But because, as is always the way, it just said restrictions, people were choosing to interpret that in a sort of unhelpful way and saying, oh, it doesn't mean that restriction. It means this thing over here. No flash photography or something like that. So the statement that was put out from government this week was saying, no, very clear, if the ticket says not to be resold, or it might say that the name of the buyer will be included on this ticket and the ID will be checked, which therefore means that you probably shouldn't be buying that off a tout, because there's probably going to be problems when you get to the venue. All of that must be clearly stated. So that was the clarification that we got from this statement last week.
Yes, so there's all that. And then the new rule is that the unique ticket number must also be stated wherever possible.
Yeah, so you mentioned that in the Consumer Rights Act, it said that a seat number must be listed. And one of the reasons for that is most tickets have terms and conditions that say the ticket must not be resold, and if it is, the ticket becomes void. And so what that means is that actually, if a promoter so wishes, they can cancel touted tickets.
Yes.
And stop the person who bought the touted ticket from getting in. And some promoters have started doing that. They're obviously both logistical and PR headaches.
Yes.
For the promoters who do that, because you get a load of people coming up the door, not being let in, and then them getting annoyed and angry and pissed off or crying. Who aren't crying people at the door of your venue?
Although, well, also, that quite often the person who would turn them away is the bouncer, who doesn't necessarily know why that ticket's being cancelled. So they'll just say, your ticket's not valid, go away. And so the person ends up blaming either the artist or the venue, probably, or just that bouncer.
Although someone did tell me last week that the savvy promoters who are doing this ticket cancelling thing don't then put the ticket back on sale. They keep a little handful of tickets at the door so that they can say to somebody, that's a cancelled ticket, but we can sell you a ticket so you can get in here at face value. And then, because the ticket you've got there is cancelled, you need to go back to StubHub, Viagogo, Seatwave, whoever, because they have a guarantee that says if you don't get in, you'll get a refund. So you will get that money back, although good luck getting your Viagogo money back. Although, of course, there's always Claire Turnham, who's become the only person in Britain as an anti-ticket touting campaigner who seems to be able to get money back from Viagogo. So there is always that option. So they're basically saying you can get in, but you'll have to pay us some more money and then get your money back, which is a solution unless you're someone who's broke. Because some people, you know, they're on very tight budgets and it may well be that they can't afford to hand over 50 quid to get in there and then, even if they can get their touted ticket back. And ultimately, we'll probably end up being better off, because they're probably going to get 100 quid back from the tout, and they're only going to pay 50 quid to get in. So that is something that some promoters have been doing, basically to try and discourage people from buying tickets from unofficial sites. The argument being, if all promoters did this, so it happened all the time, eventually people would get the message, never buy tickets from touts on websites.
Although that requires people to realise that they're buying from a secondary site and not a primary site, which is a whole other issue.
That's a whole other issue. But even if lots of promoters agreed that this was a good tactic to try and restrict secondary ticketing, you can only cancel a touted ticket if you know it's a touted ticket.
Yes.
And that was why publishing seat numbers was quite an important new regulation from the Consumer Rights Act in 2015, especially once people actually started enforcing that, which took a while. But it means that you can go onto the secondary site, see the seat numbers of the tickets being touted, and then cancel the ticket. So that helps with that process. Except, of course, in music, up until really arena-level venues, usually there aren't seat numbers. Mm. You know, even a big theatre venue like Brixton Academy, you might have an upstairs-downstairs ticket, but you don't have a specific seat to sit in. And, of course, a lot of gig venues, there are no seats. Everybody is standing. So for those sorts of music shows and festivals, of course, you know, you don't have a seat number at a festival. Publishing seat number is not enough. So that's why this idea of having a unique ticket number and making that available then extends that principle, which means that promoters can be much more proactive in cancelling touted tickets across the board. Of course, the question is, what do we mean by unique ticket number? And I mean, most ticket transactions, there will be numbers involved. There'll be a booking reference. Quite often on tickets these days, there's a barcode, and actually there will be a unique number behind the barcode.
Yeah.
But those numbers aren't necessarily immediately obvious to the people buying the ticket. So I think part of this is, if the promoters who don't like touting think there's an opportunity here, in addition to starting to cancel tickets based on ticket number, they need to set up a system where there's a really clearly marked unique number for every ticket that says this is the unique ticket number for this ticket. Hey touts, you need to declare this if you're reselling it on the platforms so that I, the promoter, can cancel your ticket. So there are some extra complications with that innovation, although out of all the things that were announced by the government last week, That is actually a new regulation that is being introduced for secondary ticketing. So it will be interesting to see whether or not that has any impact.
While we're talking about secondary ticketing, I mean, obviously some people think the ultimate solution is mobile-first ticketing, where the ticket is contained within an app on your smartphone. You can't transfer it to someone else. It's locked there to your phone. The only way you might be able to transfer it by going through an official system as part of the app, but you can't just sell it, unless you sell your phone as well, along with it, I suppose. But that doesn't seem workable as a system.
Well, it would for big shows where the tickets are really expensive, but
no. Yeah, maybe, but on the whole, no.
And some people have been saying that surely mobile ticketing is a nice, easy, technical solution to the ticket touting problem for a long time. And I suspect once mobile ticketing becomes the norm, the touts will find a way around the system, either by bundling phones into the ticket price for the big shows and maybe some other clever little ruse for the smaller shows too. But having said that, I think that a big shift over to mobile ticketing probably would restrict ticket touting to an extent. And it's surprised me really how long it has taken for mobile ticketing to really start taking off. And I suppose that's because once it became clear that mobile ticketing was only really going to work on smartphones, people tried it with like SMS tickets, didn't they?
Yeah.
On the old phones. But really, it's a smartphone solution. And I suppose even now, you can't assume everybody in the country has a smartphone. My dad does now, but my mum doesn't.
Oh.
So my dad would be able to get into your show, but my mum wouldn't. So I think that's why generally the industry has been nervous about...
I'm not sure your parents are the key demographic for most pop shows, but I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
I think the day my mum buys a smartphone is the day that the music industry can decide everyone now has a smartphone and we can go over to 100% mobile ticketing. But yeah, I mean, in some ways, that's what we're waiting for. Promoters and venues are still nervous of saying the only way you can get into this show is by having a mobile ticket. And OK, you can try and have some sort of fudge where it's mobile ticketing, only mobile tickets. But if you don't have a mobile phone that can do the ticket, then we'll have a guest list at the box office and you can show some ID and we'll give you a paper ticket. But we'll only do that on the night or something like that. But you are still sort of penalising people who don't have the phones that allow them to do the mobile ticketing. I mean, presumably we will get to a point where everyone has a smartphone in their pocket and therefore the industry would be able to force mobile ticketing onto everybody. Although I have to say, whenever I go to the airport, it still surprises me how many people who clearly have a smartphone in one hand still have a printout of their boarding pass in another hand. So even people having the devices, if they're given the option to not use their device as a ticket, might not do. But it may be that mobile ticketing is a solution that ultimately will render a lot of this conversation redundant. And of course, various startups have been playing in that space, one of which is Dice, who have also been in the news this week, although not really as a company that is fixing the touting problem.
No, so this started earlier this month. The band Shame started tweeting angrily about Dice, saying that they were putting secret booking fees onto their tickets. And I mean, this is of note because obviously booking fees are the norm in ticketing in general. But Dice, when it launched in 2014, I think, they really talked themselves up as the ticketing company that charged no booking fees.
Yeah, so Dice is a company that is trying to sort of reinvent the way the ticketing business works. A lot of the people involved in setting it up had either worked in management or in the live industry and were frustrated with the way the ticketing business worked. And so there was various things about Dice when they launched, which said, we're going to do things differently. So first of all, we have a mobile ticketing platform that actually works, because back then it was still the case that most ticketing companies, although in theory you could buy tickets through a mobile, it was a horrible experience. Secondly, there was the whole, our system will help restrict touting. And since the whole anti-touting campaign has really gained momentum in the UK around the Fanfare Alliance, Dice have been big supporters of that. But yes, the other thing was, forget secondary ticketing, what about all the problems with primary ticketing and the bloody booking fees we all hate, so that we go to a ticketing site, we think we're buying a £20 ticket, and then suddenly it's a £30 ticket. And so they made quite a big deal about how there's going to be no booking fees. But that's quite a tricky thing to take on as a startup entering the ticketing market, because in terms of live music, promoters are always used to a system whereby you go to a ticketing company and say, this is the face value of the ticket. We want all of that money when you sell a ticket on the platform. So your costs, your profit margin, you need to put a fee on top. Versus a system where the ticketing company's costs and profits are just swallowed in the face value of the ticket, which is what we do with our training events. We use Eventbrite to sell our tickets, but rather than putting Eventbrite's costs on top, we take them out of the fee that we charge, so there is just one single cost for everybody who buys those tickets. But generally in live music, that's not the way it works. So if you're a startup entering the market saying no more booking fees, well, either you've got to persuade promoters to fundamentally change the way they do business and to start swallowing the costs of the ticket transaction in the face value of the ticket, or you've got to offer a service where you just don't charge anything when you sell a ticket. But clearly that's never going to be sustainable in the long term because you as a ticketing company have somehow got to make some money.
Yeah, and Dice have looked at various ways of making money without passing on booking fees to the consumer. But actually, this is slightly different in that they've discovered that as they've grown and they've wanted to get tickets for bigger and bigger shows, the larger shows, often the promoter will say, you have to have a booking fee on this ticket. And so if they wanted to take those tickets, they had to add a booking fee on top. So they have started doing that for some shows. And so that's what's happened to Shame's tickets. Shame had worked with Dice for a long time, and they'd done so because they were like, wow, okay, you're not going to charge any booking fees to our fans can get fairly cheap tickets to see us. That's good. That helps us grow as a band. And then obviously they have grown as a band. They've got to a certain level and suddenly their tickets do have an extra fee on top, although it's presented as a flat fee in the Dice app. And that's what they started shouting off about on Twitter. Dice got into a bit of back and forth with them. And then last week, Dice put out a statement saying, this is what's happened. Shows of a certain level, it's a stipulation that you have to have a booking fee. If we want to sell tickets to those shows and grow as a company, then we have to accept that. And so on some shows, we have started adding booking fees. And we started doing that in January 2017, is what they said. And they dropped the line about being the company that charges no booking fees. Although they did admit that they probably should have been a bit more public about that, rather than a year later having a band suddenly going, hang on a minute, we've worked with you because you don't charge booking fees and now you're adding all these what look now like secret fees on top of our ticket price.
Yeah, so when you buy tickets through the Dice platform now, they are saying actually on the majority of the shows they're working on, there are still no booking fees.
Yes.
But on some shows, because of contractual commitments, because of the commercial realities of being a ticket reseller, there will be some booking fees. And they will always declare at the starting point, which to be fair, most ticketing platforms do now do, although they didn't used to, but most ticketing platforms now, the price you see on the first page on the website includes the booking fee. So you don't go through several pages of booking and then at the last minute they suddenly say, oh, by the way, it's £10 more than you thought. But there are some shows on Dice where they're charging booking fees. And it's interesting because companies like that, and there are a number of other ticketing startups that emerged at a similar time to Dice, although most of them actually have already disappeared, whereas Dice is still very much out there. But they were really trying to shake up live music and the whole ticketing thing. And in most cases, they'd recognised legitimate problems of the ticketing market that they were trying to address. But it's quite hard to pull this industry into a new way of doing business. So we'll be interesting to see how Dice further evolves as it gets bigger. Also, they've launched in the US now, haven't they? And the American live industry, again, has its own ways of doing things and it's hard to persuade them to work differently.
Yeah, and they said it was particularly the US that was asking for booking fees.
Yeah. So we'll see how that further evolves as Dice grows and grows.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus the Prince song rights up for sale on eBay. But now, the International Confederation of Music Publishers last week called on CISAC, the global grouping of songwriting collecting societies, to suspend Spanish performing rights organisation Sky because of serious concerns about the operations of the society.
Now, the Spanish collecting society, so this is Spain's equivalent of PRS, so who represent the song rights in the collective licensing domain in Spain. They've been subject to a number of controversies over the
yeah.
years. They've been raided by the police twice in the last 10 years. The first one was captured. The people were circulating a video of the police raiding, and there was lots of allegations. One guy who worked there actually went to jail. Quite a lot of us watching it were surprised that only one person went to jail, but that's what happened. He then subsequently wrote a book about his time working at the Collecting Society and all the various scandals that he was involved in along the way. And then there was a second scandal last year, another police raid, and the allegation this time was to do with an alleged scam involving certain members of Sky, the collecting society, and certain TV companies in Spain. And the scam has been dubbed The Wheel, and resulted in the Sky members who were part of this alleged scam earning a bigger share of the royalties that flow through the Collecting Society than they were perhaps otherwise due.
Yeah, so it's basically sticking songs on TV overnight in Spain. I mean, someone I spoke to about this suggested that they were sticking songs so far down in the mix on TV shows you couldn't hear them. So they could basically have music running all the way through a TV show.
That is one of the allegations, that people were being paid for the silent sync.
Yeah.
So that's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was alleged that certain Sky members had colluded with a number of executives at Spanish TV stations in order to run this scam. So there was a whole police investigation into that. ICMP's complaint, although that's part of it, it was really triggered by another recent incident where the Spanish subsidiaries of three global music publishers, Sony ATV, Warner and Peer Music, were barred from a Sky board meeting.
Yes, and so the ICMP, the Global Trade Body for Music Publishers, they sent a letter of complaint to the boss of Sky last month, basically saying that they were outraged that three of their members had been barred from this board meeting, given the ongoing controversies from last year's scandal and the investigations that are ongoing into those allegations. They also added that they had been told that the three publishers who had been barred from the meeting might be replaced by three other publishers who were possibly connected to last year's scandal. And so basically they were saying, this is all outrageous. And so what has happened last week is that the ICMP has turned to CISAC. So CISAC is a global organisation that all of the songwrite collecting societies, mainly on the performing rights side, so like PRS in the UK and Gamer in Germany and SACEM in France, they're all members of this organisation. It brings together all of those collecting societies. The reciprocal agreements between the societies are all negotiated in that forum, and certain standards are set for the way societies should operate. And so basically what ICMP are demanding is that CISAC suspend Sky's membership of CISAC and say to the Spanish society, until you sort out XYZ and you deal with these complaints, we're not going to let you be part of the global community of collecting societies. And it has to be said, that is a very bold statement for an organisation like ICMP, who do not normally go out on a limb like this, to the extent that actually, unlike IFPI, which is the global trade body for the record industry, ICMP has a much lower profile, because yes, they're not in the habit of putting out big, bold statements like this.
No, which, so they must be really pissed off.
Which made last week's statement, you know, particularly noteworthy, except, of course, we know that there have been lots of concerns about collective licensing in Spain over the last 10 years, so perhaps it's not as surprise, but it was surprisingly bold, the words they were using in this statement.
Yeah, so CISAC said it was aware of ICMP's plan to complain and would investigate thoroughly when the formal complaint came in, and said it had offered assistance to Sky in the past to get its house in order, which doesn't seem to have worked.
And it has to be said, although this is a story about a Spanish collecting society and the Spanish collective licensing system, and I suppose it was representatives of the Spanish subsidiaries of these publishers who were kicked out of the board meeting last year, because of the way collective licensing works, issues like this in any one country do actually affect songwriters all over the world, because all the collecting societies in the world are joined up through these reciprocal agreements. So if you're a PRS member in the UK, but you tour elsewhere in Europe, the local promoters, the venues who are putting on your shows, they have to get a license to cover the copyright and the songs that you are performing, which may well be your songs. But they don't do a deal with PRS, they do a deal with their local collecting society. So a Spanish venue, Spanish promoter, they would get a license from Sky. You then go and perform your songs at your gig. Venue promoter pay local collecting society the royalties, who then pass it to PRS in the UK with a little bit of data, who then ultimately pay you your royalties. So if you are a songwriter who are a PRS member and you have allowed PRS to represent your rights across the world, they are often reliant on the local societies to collect the money and pass the money over. And that's one of the weaknesses of collective licensing. There's lots of things that is great about collective licensing, and there should be more collective licensing, except when you go around the world, there are a lot of rubbish collecting societies. And some are inept, and some are outright corrupt. And, you know, that's a problem if ultimately you are reliant on those local societies to collect some of your money, and you don't actually have any direct control over those societies because you're not members. Whereas I suppose the global publishers tend to participate in most of the societies. So although one of the other issues you sometimes get in collective licensing is that the songwriters feel perhaps the societies are working too much for the publishers, or sometimes the other way around, and that both sides are not being represented, in some ways, British songwriters rely on the global publishers to sort of make a stand against those societies which don't seem to be operating in the best interests of the songwriting community at large.
Yeah, so I mean, like you said, the latest in a long line of controversies surrounding Sky. We will see if this starts to clear things up there. I'm not sure it will, but we'll see. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. If you're not listening to this as soon as it goes out, the Brits may already have happened. They take place this Wednesday, and they've just announced a plan to support the Time's Up campaign against sexual assault, harassment and inequality in the workplace, part of the wider Me Too movement. And like a kind of an unofficial protest at the Grammys this year, where people carried white roses up the red carpet, the Brits will officially support that. That was a campaign set up by Voices in Entertainment, which is a group in the US. And so people will be given white rose pins to wear on their evening wear as they walk up the red carpet.
Yeah, so the Brits are sort of making that element of the show official. So they'll be distributing these little pins. Obviously, it's voluntary. No one's going to be forced to wear them. People will choose to wear them. And this organisation, Voices in Entertainment, who organised the thing at the Grammys, are endorsing this and
yes,
saying that they're glad to see the Brits embracing this and trying to continue that conversation about the action that needs to be taken in the music industry, in the entertainment industry, and in the world at large, in order to end sexual assault, harassment and inequality in the workplace.
And the music industry broadly has announced its support for the EU's new Music Moves Europe programme.
Yeah, this is an initiative that the European Commission have been working on for a couple of years, but properly launched last week, although it's actually a pilot programme to see how the European Commission, through its culture directorate, could be supporting the music industry. Culture's not a huge part of the EU's remit, although they do support various initiatives. As far as I can see in the past, most of it has been handed over to the movie industry. they subsidise quite a lot of movie projects that involve multiple countries in the EU. And so music companies have been saying for a while, hey, what about us? Why aren't you supporting us? And so this new initiative is going to pilot a bunch of stuff, the hope being that it becomes a permanent support and funding programme for music companies and music makers, kicking off in about 2021. So it means that the UK won't get to benefit from the permanent programme.
Hooray!
Because we would have long Brexited by then.
Well, we'll see.
But yes, pretty much every trade body in music that has anything like a European remit was backing this. So it was another one of those where a statement came out with about 87 logos at the top for every one of those organisations.
Taylor Swift has had a lawsuit against her claiming that she stole a song dismissed on the grounds that her lyrics are too banal to be considered stolen from anywhere.
Yeah, so this related to Players Who Play and Haters Who Hate.
Yes.
The allegation being that those notable lyrics from her hit Shake It Off were stolen from a 2001 track. So the writers of the original track were suing. Taylor Swift's people were very dismissive of the case from the start and sought to have it dismissed. And that is what has happened. Basically, the judge said it is true that there is a similarity between the lyrics of this 2001 track and the Taylor Swift track. They both talk about players playing, both talk about haters hating, but players playing and haters hating, that's just the world. And you can't possibly copyright a lyric that says something that generic, basically,
yes,
is what they were saying.
Judges commenting on popular culture is a long-running and amusing genre of legal news. This is actually unusual for that sort of story. The judge seemed quite well informed in this case, but the quotes that came out, one, the quote that everyone picked up on was that she said that the lyrics were too banal.
Yes, to be protected by copyright.
And then there was the quote, American popular culture was, by 2001, heavily steeped in the concepts of players, haters, and player haters, which I would like a video of the judge saying that.
The judge did give the songwriters of the original song an opportunity to resubmit their litigation if they could find other ways in which Shake It Off infringed on their song that didn't involve players playing and haters hating.
Not sure that's going to happen.
Yeah, the judge basically said that in the judgment as well.
You'll find links to all those stories and everything we've discussed this week in the show notes for this episode at setlistpodcast.com. We're very, very short on time now, so let's just get on with this And Finally story. And finally, this week, the publishing rights in the lyrics of Prince's debut single have been put up for sale on eBay. Producer Chris Moon, who co-wrote the song Soft and Wet for Prince's original demo tape, has decided he doesn't want his cut of it anymore.
Yeah, a lot of people reporting on this story, their headline was, you could buy a co-write credit on a Prince song.
That's not what you're buying.
That's not what you're buying. What you're buying is this guy's slice of the copyright in that song.
Yeah, he will still be the co-writer of the song.
He will still. You can't rewrite history. And that means, as much as this is being presented as being a really unusual thing, copyrights are bought and sold every day of the week.
Yes.
So that in itself isn't that unusual. Although it is true that they're not usually bought and sold on eBay.
No.
So that bit is quite interesting. And basically, if you're willing to invest in buying this slice of this Prince song, you will then be a co-owner in the copyright in that song, which means you will earn royalties whenever that song is played or exploited. And who wouldn't want to own a share of royalties stemming from a Prince track? That's got to be worth some money.
It's got to be worth some money. Although nowhere in Chris Moon's listing does he suggest that you would earn money from the original Prince song. He's more keen to talk up an MC Hammer track that sampled it in 1990.
Yeah, this despite the fact that we are expecting a number of sort of Prince collections and catalogue releases and all of that.
Well, and just that there's generally more interest in Prince's catalogue as a whole at the moment anyway.
But yes, in the eBay listing, this guy, Chris Moon, describes in quite some detail how his life was basically made the day that MC Hammer, albeit on MC Hammer's big hit album, recorded his own version of this song and the money that he's earned from that.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, when this song was released, it wasn't the Chris Moon's original production that was the single. It was when Prince got signed to Warner, he re-recorded the song himself as with him as the producer. But see, Chris Moon still owned his share of the song as one of its co-writers. I mean, it wasn't a massive hit. It was Prince's debut single. Fair enough, it's not going to be a massive hit. I don't think the album was a massive hit. It was later that Prince got really big and became the huge artist that we now know him as. So perhaps 12 years later, when MC Hammer sampled it, that really did change his life, because, you know, he's saying that MC Hammer album sold 10 million copies when it first came out. It went on to sell 22 million copies. It's been really lucrative. But he really talks it up like that MC Hammer album, that's just going to keep on selling. It's going to keep on selling. You'll always be able to earn money from MC Hammer. We all know how successful MC Hammer continues to be to this very day. And this little artist, Prince, he's not really, I don't think he'll ever be a success.
Although subsequently in his eBay blurb, he then sort of starts playing down the fact that you might want to buy his share of this song to make money.
Yeah.
And more that you would just want to do it to be able to have an interest in a little bit of Prince history.
Yeah, he talks up how much he's enjoyed owning the song, and now he feels like it's just time for someone else to own it and enjoy the pleasure you get from simply owning a bit of a Prince song. Like, he talked about it like, you know, like owning a bit of the Berlin Wall or owning a moon rock or something.
So if you are the Prince fan that he believes is out there,
yeah,
probably is out there, to
yes,
be honest. Although you would have to have $490,000 in the bank.
Well, he is open to offers
in order to bid for this. He doesn't really give any information on what the annual royalty income is.
No,
currently.
Which I suppose that's what makes it unusual, because that's what normally people would want to know.
I don't think it even says what his share is in the song.
No, he just says that he owns the lyrics. He said, yeah, I own the lyrics and Prince owns the music. But I mean, that doesn't say that, that doesn't mean it's a 50-50 split. The percentage, we don't know.
And we don't know, because obviously a chunk of that will go through a collecting society. So basically, there's very little information in the blurb that you would expect to receive if you were going to take an interest in a copyright and recoup your investment on the royalties. But hey, you'll get an association with Prince, and maybe even more importantly than that, you'll get a lifelong association with MC Hammer, and he seems to think that alone is worth 490 grand.
Yes, so if you've got that money knocking around, just go in and just buy it now, or yeah, make him an offer. That's also a possibility. Who knows what it'll go for? We recently talked about Paul Cattermole from S Club 7 trying to sell his Brit Awards on eBay. That hasn't gone so well, but we'll see. What he needed was an MC Hammer association.
That was a fake bids problem, though, wasn't
yes.
it? People offering lots of money, and then it turned out they hadn't got the money.
Yeah, this is just buy it now. Although you could pretend, I don't know, maybe you. Can you put $500,000 on a credit card? I don't know.
No, you're only allowed to bid for this if you genuinely have 490 grand and you are a big MC Hammer fan. Those are the conditions.
That's all we've got time for this week. Like, rate, review, share this episode wherever you found it and wherever you like. You can email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. The show is presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. For more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.